Time now for StoryCorps, recording conversations between everyday people. Today, a love story that began in the Catskills. It was the summer of 1946. Honey Feller and her identical twin sister, Bunny, were waitresses at a hotel. Another set of identical twins, Elliot and Danny Riken, worked as musicians in a band there. At StoryCorps, Honey and Elliot recall what happened when the twins met the twins.
When we met, you and your sister couldn't tell us apart, and we couldn't tell you two apart.
But by the end of the summer, there was no chance of separating us. And we had a double wedding. You and I were married the same day as Bunny and Danny were married. And it was two brides, two grooms, one set of parents for each. The gowns were identical gowns. The flowers were identical.
We both went on our honeymoon to Miami Beach by different trains.
Yeah, so people wouldn't
be so obvious that people would be staring at us. You know,
yeah, the twins that married the twins.
What did you think about marrying me many years ago?
You bowled me over with your way of kissing and the way you hold me when we dance. You're not a fantastic dancer, but you hold me fantastically, and I feel it. It's genuine. You're just not phony. I don't think you have a phony bone in your body. And I never thought anybody lasts this many years.
Like just yesterday, it was our 50th anniversary.
Yeah, now it's 11 years after that.
Yeah.
I never feel, what will he do if I die first? You know how to open tuna fish. You know how to smear it with mayonnaise. You will not fall apart. You'll feel sad when I'm gone, but you'll manage, and that makes me feel very good. Thank you for being you, Elliot. You made my life complete.
And I say the same. You made my life complete, and hope we go on for another 50 years.
I'll take five good ones. Five good ones, and I'll say thank you, God.
The voices of Honey and Elliot Riken at StoryCorps in New York City. The Rikens live in Brooklyn, in the same house they bought with their twins over 50 years ago. Honey's sister, Bunny, still lives right upstairs. Their interview will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. You can see the four of them on their wedding day at NPR.org.
And this is the time of year when new college graduates are plunging into the job market for the first time. Human resources managers say many are unprepared for the demands of the workplace. That's what researchers at York College found. So now the Pennsylvania school is training its students in professionalism as well as liberal arts. Joel Rose reports.
A few weeks before graduation, dozens of York College undergrads in shorts and flip-flops pack into a campus auditorium.
Dude, dress up. This isn't the mall.
They've come to see Laura Wand. She's the director of marketing for Johnson Controls, one of York's biggest employers. With her PowerPoint slides and gray pantsuit, Wand tries to impart some helpful advice from the real world.
Multitasking is a myth. You got a great job, turn off the cell phone, stop texting.
Wand is here at the invitation of York College's Center for Professional Excellence. Researchers asked hundreds of business leaders and human resources managers around the country to assess the professionalism of recent college graduates. York College professor David Polk says the results were sobering.
What we found was that there are a set of qualities, characteristics that these folks would like to see in new college graduates, but unfortunately they tend to be lacking.
Those qualities include the ability to communicate and listen respectfully, motivation to finish the task at hand, and attention to appearance. But Polk says researchers did find one area where recent graduates stand out.
There's a sense of entitlement that we've picked up on, where people think they're entitled to become, let's say, president of the company within the next 2 years. They're entitled to 5 weeks of vacation.
So Polk is helping to develop a curriculum to teach professionalism. York College President George Waldner says his isn't the only liberal arts school that's trying to do a better job of preparing students for the workplace.
Historically, a lot of colleges have felt, well, there's this dreary old world out there, but we're kind of like a monastery. Except the problem is for the students, they have to get out of that monastery and go out into the real world. It's not fair to the students to not really alert them to the fact that they do have to make these transitions.
Some students seem eager for any advantage they can get. Senior Evan Smrek attended Laura Wan's talk on professionalism.
So you're hitting the job market?
Yes, I'll be hitting the job market in less than a month now.
A little scared?
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Do you think that this gave you any ideas for how to approach that better?
Yes, actually. They mentioned some aspects of interviews or just how to conduct yourself that I was kind of like, oh, okay, I wish I had known that a month ago when I had my interview. But definitely something to take away for following interviews.
One helpful hint, when you sit down for that first interview, do not ask how many weeks of vacation the position offers. But other students are not in such a hurry to join the workforce. I found freshmen Zachary Starner and Brandon Fogel in the basement of the student center.
So right now I'm just really enjoying the college experience. Shooting some pool here down in Spartan's Den.
Once I get closer to graduation, I would probably be more interested in professionalism because then I'd be more likely to find a job.
For now, they have more pressing things to worry about, like whose stripes and whose solids. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Next week on Morning Edition's Business Report, we'll hear from new college graduates across the country who are now entering the job market. They'll tell you just how tough it is.
Coming from a small town, when you go to a prestigious school, you graduate with a great degree, and then you come back and you don't have anything. It doesn't look real good.
That's from our series Setting Out, next week on Morning Edition's Business Report.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the mysteries of the universe, and pondered by scientists, philosophers, and theologians for centuries, is the really big question, why are we here? Why are there galaxies, planets, humans, Twinkies, all of this matter? Where did it come from? Why is the universe almost entirely matter, and not the infamous antimatter instead? Well, a new experiment from the Tevatron Particle Collider at the Fermilab may give us a few clues about that. Joining me now to talk about that, plus a few tidbits of news from this week's meeting at the American Astronomical Society, is my guest, the guy who puts the Ron in astronomy, Ron Cowan,
astronomer, hi, Ira,
physicist, writer at Science News in Washington. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thanks very much.
You can find Ron's blog over at sciencenews.org. Let's get into this idea. Tell us about this experiment at Fermilab.
Okay. Well, in this experiment, protons and antiprotons are collided together. And, you know, anytime matter meets up with antimatter, the two destroy each other. They're like they're equal and opposite counterparts, and you get pure energy.
Right.
But some particles were created in this experiment, and actually matter and antimatter was created in particular a very short-lived type of elementary particle called a B meson and its antiparticle, the anti-B meson. And the thing of it is that what they found was that there seemed to be, even though equal numbers of B mesons and anti-B mesons were produced, when these very short-lived particles each decayed, you ended up with a little bit more, about 1% more matter than antimatter. And the reason that's so important is that we believe that when the universe began in the Big Bang, there were equal parts, matter and antimatter. And if it stayed that way the whole time, they would have destroyed each other on contact, and there would just be pure energy. Somehow or other, there had to be an imbalance, and the imbalance had to have happened, we think, pretty soon after the birth of the universe. And the standard model of particle physics says, well, there could be a little bit of imbalance, a little bit more of matter than antimatter, but it wouldn't even be enough to make one single galaxy. This experiment is saying, you know what, at very high energies, there's some other difference between matter and antimatter that we don't understand yet, and that enough matter, more matter is made than antimatter to create galaxies and planets and people and everything around us today.
So that 1% really makes a difference for all the matter we're seeing today over time, I guess, over the billions of years.
Yes. I mean, that 1% is, even though tiny, is much, much more than what the standard model permits. And they think this could be the answer. They're not sure. One caveat is that there might be other reactions that went on when the universe was so hot and so energetic. We're talking about a trillionth of a second after the birth of the universe. And there could be other reactions going on. This may not be the one,
right,
but it could be. And so that's what they're so giddy and excited about.
Let's talk about another bit of news from the Astronomical Society meeting. The discovery of a really interesting planetary system that's very different from our own, right?
Right, that's right. I mean, in our own solar system, pretty much all the planets orbit as if they're bugs glued on the same flat phonograph record. They all orbit in the same plane on the same flat disk.
Save one.
Hmm?
Save one planet.
I guess is that...
I think Uranus is or something.
Neptune,
one of those. We'll have to check. I know there's
yeah,
one.
I have to check. but pretty much they all lie in the same on the same disk. So for the first time, they were able to look in detail at a planetary system beyond our own. It's the star which has these three known planets. Yeah. It's called Epsilon Andromeda. It's 45 light years away, which is relatively close. And, you know, you can't see the planets themselves, but you can measure properties based on the gravitational tug they exert on their parent star. And they see that the two biggest planets, and they really are massive, they're many times more massive than Jupiter, orbit not like bugs on a phonograph disk, but a 30-degree angle to each other. And so, you know, this system may have started out like the Sun and a nice flat disk, but it's certainly evolved differently. And it's another sort of, you might call it a slap in the face to the solar system that, you know, we like to think of our solar system perhaps as a typical planetary system, but it may not.
Yeah.
You know, we've already found all these huge Jupiter mass planets that are within roasting distance of their parent star, much closer than our innermost planet, Mercury, is to our Sun. Mm-hmm. And now here's another difference.
Interesting. And the last bit of news is about a black hole that is not in the center of its galaxy, like it is in ours, right?
That's right. And we, you know, the standard picture has always been, you know, these supermassive black holes, millions to billions times the mass of the Sun, well, you know, their gravity, they settle right into the center of their parent galaxy. Maybe the galaxy forms around them. But in this galaxy called M87, which has been studied a fair amount, we know there's a black hole there, and now they've seen that the supermassive black hole is actually off-center by about 22 light years. It may be that something definitely did kick this black hole out of the center. It may have been that M87 suffered a collision with another galaxy a few billion years ago that also had a supermassive black hole. And when those two met up, they kicked each other off center. Mm-hmm. It's also possible this galaxy has a big jet in the center, twin jets. One of the jets may have also have kicked this off center. But it's an interesting finding, and it also, especially if the galaxy merger explanation is right, whenever you see an off-center black hole, it may be telling you, hey, this galaxy underwent some kind of violent collision in the past, and may be a marker of that.
It's always great to have these things that no one expects in astronomy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Ron.
Sure.
Thanks for coming on and taking time to talk with us. Have a good holiday weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Ron Cowan is the astronomy and physics writer at Science News in Washington, and you can follow his blog at sciencenews.org.
The Sex and the City juggernaut continues with the second feature film based on the HBO series. The four female protagonists are still friends. Three of them are married now, but in this film, they leave New York and head to Abu Dhabi. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
I am currently embroiled in several email exchanges about Sex and the City 2 with three female friends and colleagues. We all dislike it. No, dislike isn't the word. We think it's appalling. The difference is that I, who had a love-hate relationship with the series, find it easy to lob insults, while they feel betrayed. They could live with the first movie, but here comes Sex and the City 2 to turn something that either challenged or inspired or just gave them a blessed escape into an all-out drag show with arch one-liners and product placements and almost no emotional heft. The Sex and the City dynamic has always been fragile. At its most affecting, you could see beyond the materialism and artifice and feel the four female protagonists, Carrie and Miranda and Samantha and Charlotte, fighting for validation and connecting with one another via that struggle. They were dissimilar, but that was the point. They didn't threaten one another. They weren't catty in the way that so many female friendships are falsely portrayed on screen. They could empathize, but also offer detached and witty perspectives. And Carrie could try to sum it all up in her column. Now, in Sex and the City 2, there's nothing left but surface. And what a surface. The movie is written and directed by Michael Patrick King, and I can almost hear him cackling as he cooked it up. Let's start with an over-the-top gay wedding with Liza Minnelli marrying the couple. Then we'll send the girls to Abu Dhabi so they can rile up the fundamentalists with their revealing clothes and flagrant sexuality. Then they'll make fun of women in traditional black Muslim garb with lines like, "Certainly cuts down on the Botox bill." But later, they'll join these repressed women in campy feminist solidarity. And won't our girls look great, swishing around the desert, being waited on by smooth young Arab men? Well, no, they don't look great. And with their plastic smiles and forced gaiety, scene after scene is cringeworthy. This scene is actually the best of them, a lunch in which Kim Cattrall's Samantha lays out her vitamins and pills, while Sarah Jessica Parker's Carrie and Cynthia Nixon's Miranda look on in amazement.
Wow, that's a whole lot of health. How many are you working there?
44. I'm on the one-a-day Fruity Pebbles plant. Women our age shouldn't joke about vitamins.
Women who are not our age shouldn't say women our age. Yeah.
Well, one day, very soon, you will thank me. I am leading the way through the menopause maze with my vitamins, my melatonin sleep patches, my bioidentical estrogen cream, progesterone cream, a touch of testosterone.
She's the hormone whisperer.
I am. I've tricked my body into thinking it's younger.
I've tricked my body into thinking it's thinner. Spanx.
And I'm telling you, no hot flashes, no mood swings in my sex drive. It's right back to where it was.
Really? Hadn't heard.
At least that scene introduces the theme of aging. But the rest of the time, Cattrall is in skimpy dresses, throwing herself at studly males. There is a nominal plot. Since Carrie and Chris Noth's Mr. Big got married, he wants to stay home and watch old movies, while she wants to go out. Miranda has troubles with her boss. Charlotte is taxed by motherhood. In Abu Dhabi, where they accompany Samantha on a PR trip at the behest of a sheikh, Carrie bumps into an old flame, Aiden, and feels a tug. But like every other scene, this one is full of melodramatic gestures, and the director's timing is so bad, you can see every joke limping its way toward you from across the desert. In a movie in which every entrance is meant to make you cry, fabulous, in which Carrie's outfits cost as much as $50,000, it's worth saying that the designers, and especially the cinematographer, have not flattered the actresses. And Sarah Jessica Parker, a good comedian with endearing rocky poise, looks better when she's not swanning around. For all the smutty double entendres, Sex and the City 2 is a pale shade of vanilla, except for one scene. Cattrall, stuffed in short shorts in the Arab marketplace, has a flurry of hot flashes, drops to the ground, and writhes around, moaning, "I have sex, yes, I quite enjoy it." Samantha's identity is so invested in her audacious sexuality that all the contradictions produce a convulsive fit, a fugue state. The scene pushes the boundaries. I frankly had to avert my eyes. But at least it connects with real longing, real desperation, in ways that the rest of Sex and the City 2 doesn't come near.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see clips from Sex and the City 2 at our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
This long Memorial Day weekend, AAA expects 32 million people to travel. That's up 5% from last year and seems to be a sign that tourism is improving along with the economy, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
It seems the once fashionable staycation may be on the way out. This is the first time in 5 years AAA is projecting an increase in travelers for Memorial Day weekend. Troy Green is with AAA.
Some Americans, and I emphasize some Americans, are feeling a little more confident about their personal financial situations.
Though much like the broader economy, the travel business is nowhere near pre-recession levels. Still, Green says destinations like the national parks, Washington, D.C., and the amusement parks in Orlando will be busy this weekend. Mark Nelson is getting ready.
It's going to be a madhouse. It's going to be Mickey ears everywhere.
Nelson is the director of sales at the Royal Plaza Resort in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. Think Disney World.
Every one of our hotels along the street here will be full, and people are going to be smiling and happy. And therefore, so will we.
This time last year, Nelson says the rooms weren't so full. He says travelers are returning in bigger numbers now, but they want to pay less and get more, like room upgrades or free breakfast. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.